Biggest two-day exercise study ever validates the energy problems in ME/CFS, Part 1, by Court Johnson, July 10th, 2024. Every once in a while in the chronic fatigue syndrome world, we get a really big study, and this is one of those. For one, it validates and expands upon the findings of past smaller two-day exercise studies, and that's a big deal. The two-day exercise studies, after all, occupy a unique place not only in ME/CFS, but in the medical research world, and that means trouble. It's tough overturning paradigms, but that's what the two-day exercise studies that the Workwell Foundation initiated in ME/CFS over two decades ago aimed to do. Look up two-day CPET on PubMed, and you'll find a lot of ME/CFS studies and not much else. There's a reason for that. The two-day exercise studies were largely abandoned decades ago after researchers concluded that even people with serious medical conditions were able to duplicate the results of their first day on the second day. It seems that human beings, even when they are very ill, can produce the same amount of energy from one day to the next. At least, that was the thinking until Stacy Stevens and the Workwell Foundation showed, in a landmark study, that was not true for ME/CFS. The results were so shocking that the exercise physiology world essentially ignored them. Since then, though, ME/CFS researchers have, in mostly small studies, been working at validating Workwell's initial findings, but now they've really taken hold. Then again, we've never had a big, really rigorously produced two-day CPET study that's seemed guaranteed to turn heads. That is, until now. The study. The study titled Cardiopulmonary and Metabolic Responses During a Two-Day CPET in Myalgic Encephalomyelitis Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, Translating Reduced Oxygen Consumption to Impairment Status to Treatment Considerations. This was led by exercise physiologist Betsy Keller, and is easily the biggest and best two-day ME/CFS cardiopulmonary exercise study done to date. The two-day CPET test is unique in that while one-day CPET and invasive cardiopulmonary exercise studies can tell us what happens during exercise, the two-day CPET studies have been able to show us how exercise one day impacts the ability to produce energy the next day. The very definition of post-exertional malaise. These studies, which require patients to exercise to exhaustion twice over 2 days, must be amongst the most difficult to pull off. Not only does the patient have to engage in two short but intense exercise sessions over 2 days, a big commitment, even a sacrifice for a person with ME/CFS, but if they've traveled, they'll probably have to book some rest days before they can leave. Those restrictions made the size and scope of this study unusual. The reason this complex study, which took place over 4 years, was able to get so large was simple. It got some very nice NIH funding via Maureen Hansen's Cornell ME/CFS Collaborative Research Center. Maureen Hansen's decision to regularly employ exercise stressors in her NIH-funded center has paid off in spades with this study and others that have moved the ME/CFS field forward considerably. Once again, we see how valuable the NIH-funded research centers and NIH-funded studies can be. Few groups fund studies of the size and complexity that the NIH regularly funds. Rigorous effort. The authors went to great lengths to dot their I's and cross their T's. The patients met the Canadian criteria for ME/CFS, and, importantly, the healthy controls were sedentary. The lead author, Betsy Keller, met with the exercise technicians to practice the test protocol, confirm calibration and long-term quality control and assurance with biocalibration of metabolic measurement systems. This is important as CPET machines can be touchy. AI Copilot reported that CPET machines require careful handling and proper calibration. and can be sensitive to things like patient movement, improper sensor placement, and environmental conditions. CPET machines, for instance, have to be calibrated for altitude. For Betsy Keller and the exercise physiologists at Workwell, Stacy and Jared Stevens in this study, calibration usually requires having the machines tested using a human subject with known readings to make sure they are reading accurately. In short, we can assume that the ME/CFS patients were real ME/CFS patients and that the cardiopulmonary exercise test was done properly. A little controversy. The two main ME/CFS exercise groups in the US, the Workwell-Keller group working with Maureen Hansen and Dane Cook's group that's been working with the CDC, have been at loggerheads for years. Early on, Workwell asserted that Cook's submaximal testing procedure was A, effective at uncovering the aerobic impairments found in ME/CFS, and B, exposed ME/CFS to increased levels of stress. For his part, for almost 20 years, Cook has asserted that Workwell, Keller, Vermeulen, everyone except him actually, have been assessing their exercise results incorrectly. Their results, Cook asserted, needed to be matched for aerobic fitness. Cook got similar results to the other studies until he controlled for aerobic fitness. Once he did that, most notably in a recent large CDC exercise study, all the problems with energy production disappeared. Cook had an explanation for exercise problems in ME/CFS, but it was markedly different. He proposed that metabolic problems at the cellular level were throwing ME/CFS patients' breathing patterns off. His assertion that the early entry into the anaerobic energy production, the reduced oxygen consumption, the reduced ability to do work, etc., seen during exercise, were all incorrect, struck at the heart of what we thought we knew about ME/CFS. On both a physiological and personal level, these findings seem to make so much sense, but here we were with an issue that needed to be addressed, and which this study finally did by controlling for aerobic fitness. Were the energy impairment findings during exercise findings a statistical fluke, or were they real? Results. The first CPET. This study found they were real after all. Even after controlling for aerobic fitness, the Keller group found that during exercise, ME/CFS patients overall had a lower capacity to do work, took a shorter time to reach peak effort, had reduced ventilatory function, O2 consumption, CO2 production, and oxygen pulse compared to the healthy controls. In other words, in contrast to Cook's results, this study found that ME/CFS patients could not produce as much energy, use as much oxygen, last as long, or do as much work as the sedentary healthy controls. What gives? Keller et al. Proposed that Cook had his own matching problem, noting that about 10% of Cook's samples matched males with females. They proposed that sex differences in oxygen carrying capacity, blood flows, blood volume, etc., etc., could have caused Cook to miss the reduced levels of oxygenation and energy production that was present. Pulse pressure. Next, the Keller group focused on pulse pressure, the difference between the diastolic and systolic blood pressures during peak load, i.e., the point at which the participants' systems were most stressed. Pulse pressure is an important indicator of cardiovascular health. While an increased pulse pressure can reflect hardening of the arteries, a narrowed pulse pressure can indicate problems with blood flows. The narrowed pulse pressure found in the ME/CFS patients suggested that total peripheral resistance, i.e., resistance in the blood vessels to blood flows, was present. A variety of past findings could help explain why that might be so in ME/CFS. Hypoperfusion, the inability to provide adequate blood flows, endothelial dysfunction, blood vessel problems, reduced stroke volume, blood outflows from the heart, preload failure, inability to load the heart with enough blood, and smaller heart size could all be contributing to problems with blood flows. This suggested that impaired blood flows and oxygen delivery are contributing to the reduced energy production during exercise they found in the ME/CFS patients. With the focus on energy metabolism and blood flows, we are right back where we started prior to the publication of the Cook study. Effort preference? With the Cook study apparently out of the way, they took on NATH's intramural study next, noting that the results of the small CPET portion of the study were in line with others. They agreed with the author's conclusion that autonomic nervous system problems contributed to the results, but there the similarities ended. Keller et al. Called the use of the effort preference reward test, or EPRT, used, and the conclusion that reduced effort preference contributed to the CPET findings misguided. Noting that the EPRIT test was developed for depression and that the findings have never been highly associated with oxygen, they also asserted that small CPET study suffered from its own patient matching problems. The jump from the effort preference findings to the study's conclusion that the problem lay in broken pathways in the brain and that nothing was wrong with the muscles was one of the more dicey parts of the study. It seemed to fly in the face of several studies that have found muscle problems in ME/CFS. Keller et al. Proposed that problems in the muscles, such as poor signaling due to vagus nerve problems and accumulation of muscle metabolites and damage to the brainstem, could also explain the reduced muscle activation the NATH study found. Looking at things more systemically, they proposed that both low blood volume and blood vessel dysfunction could signal the brainstem to put the brakes on exercise in ME/CFS. Plus, their CPET studies don't show reductions in peak effort. Instead, they proposed that ME/CFS patients' early entry into anaerobic energy production during exercise naturally makes things more effortful for them. Second CPET exercise test. The findings from the second CPET exercise test followed on the findings from the first. From the already low first exercise test, the results, further reductions in peak work, time to peak exercise, ventilatory measures, heart rate, O2 pulse, and rate pressure product, indicated that the first exercise test had indeed damaged ME/CFS patients' ability to produce energy. Contrast that with the sedentary but healthy controls who displayed a normal recovery from the exercise and no change in energy production, peak oxygen consumption, or peak work. The study also found that the first exercise session damaged the ability of the hearts of ME/CFS patients to respond normally during the second exercise session, i.e., the ME/CFS patients, but not the healthy controls, demonstrated chronotropic incompetence. In contrast to Cook's focus on peak VO2, which assesses the maximum aerobic capacity present or one's peak ability to produce energy, Workwell and Keller have always emphasized the importance of assessing ME/CFS patients at their ventilatory anaerobic threshold. This is the point at which a person relies more and more on anaerobic energy production. It's also the point at which toxic byproducts from anaerobic energy production start producing pain, fatigue, and other symptoms. In other words, it's the point at which people stop exerting themselves. In their study, ME/CFS patients reached that point at lower levels of energy production, workload, and heart rate. Cook has been more focused on peak aerobic capacity, the point in the test where someone produces their peak energy levels. That focus makes some sense with healthy controls, but ignores the possibility that some people with ME/CFS can produce normal or even high peak levels of energy at some point in the test, but can't maintain them. I know an ME/CFS patient who had abnormally high peak aerobic capacity, but who was very low functioning. She can temporarily produce high amounts of energy, but her aerobic window fades quickly, leaving her very impaired. Conclusion. The largest and most rigorous two-day cardiopulmonary exercise done to date did a couple of significant things. For one, it validated, hopefully once and for all, the highly unusual problem with exercise that afflicts people with ME-CFS. Exercise almost always makes people stronger, but in people with ME-CFS, intense exercise in particular does not. Instead, it damages them. In no other disease to date has a short but intense bout of exercise knocked a person's energy production system for a loop. This finding, of course, potentially explains so much about a disease that's been characterized as a systemic exertion intolerance disorder. It helps explain why studies have indicated that people with ME-CFS are significantly less functional than people with other serious illnesses. I still remember being gobsmacked by Workwell's first two-day CPET study way back in 2009. It is still probably my most exciting ME-CFS moment, and I vividly remember the title of the blog I wrote, A Crack in the Foundation. And you can see that link, of course, in the text version of the article. I thought, my God, this is it. Everything is going to change after this study. And it has been changing, but so much more slowly than I thought it would have. Now, though, we finally have the big study to lay all the objections to rest. Will it change things? I'm sure it will. How quickly? I have no idea. I think it's time, though, to say thank you to all the pioneers who plugged away for so many years at resurrecting these difficult tests, and in doing so, paved the way for this study to happen. They are courageous people who have bucked the system, perhaps at a cost to themselves. So thank you so much, Stacy and Jared Stevens, Chris Snell, Mark Van Ness, and Todd Davenport at Workwell. Thank you, Betsy Keller and her Ithaca group, and Maureen Hansen at Cornell. Thank you to the Van Kampen, Rowe, and Weiser team. Thank you, Rudy Vermeulen and your group. And thanks, more recently, to Jong Han Lim and his Korean group. Thanks also to Yvette to alerting me about this study and so many more. We'll see what happens from here. Coming up, part two, the author's treatment recommendations given the low energy state people with ME-CFS find themselves in. Counting down on Health Rising's summer drive. We're just days away from ending Health Rising's summer donation drive. Thanks so much to the over 250 people who have brought us to almost 80% of our goal. If you think uncovering what's happening during exercise is going to be key to solving these diseases, you're in the right place. Over the past 10 years, Health Rising has published over 70 blogs on exercise and ME-CFS, long COVID, and fibromyalgia. If that's the kind of work you want to see continue, please support us in a way that works for you, and you can give a one-time donation at the link in the text version of the article.